Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the Alliance of Sahel States, the new regional bloc challenging ECOWAS. I'm joined by a very important guest, Mr. Ryder Laimori. Ryder is the Senior Sahel and West Africa Advisor at Navanti Group. United States. Ryder has extensive experience spanning over 10 years as a researcher, a policy advisor, analyst, and practitioner with different organizations, including the United States, United Nations, and EU organizations. Ryder, very delighted to have you join me today, and I look forward to a very fruitful conversation with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael, and looking forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Brilliant. So let's start off. So for those that may not know about this new regional bloc, this alliance of Sahel states, what is this alliance of Sahel states? What is the motivation behind them, and what is its significance in the region?
It's a very good question to lay out the basics on that. I think the creation of this new alliance came in the back of a series of coup d'etats that took place in the last 3 years in the three countries: Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso. These are the three countries that formed this alliance of the Sahel. All the three countries witnessed coup d'etats, as I mentioned, in the past 3 years. And then it started in Mali, followed by Burkina Faso, and then in Niger. The creation of the alliance came after these countries increasingly became isolated and making the decisions choosing new alliances, new partnerships with countries that are not usually traditional in terms of collaborations with these countries. Additionally, the three countries made the decision to step away from the regional body, ECOWAS, and because of the tensions that were created following the coup d'etat, and therefore the three countries were looking for new ways to challenge the ECOWAS, and also to establish this narrative to convince their supporters and their base of supporters, and to convince the Malians, the Nigerians, and the Burkinabes that this is the best way going forward. Is to be isolated, to work together, and not rely on the traditional partners that these countries collaborated with in the past. And the excuse used by the three countries, by the juntas, by the military leaders in this country is also is that collaboration with the West, for example, in general, with the US or France, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this a little bit more later, you know, that the collaboration have not brought the stability that was desired and not brought, you know, development of these countries. So therefore, those juntas are looking into a new vision, new ways, new partners, so they can achieve the stability that people in the region, you know, the desire. Although, you know, a lot of these decisions have been questioned by the West, questions by the oppositions in these countries. They still manage to garner some support, especially like domestic support, and continue to explore partnerships with new international partners specifically. So this alliance is made out of Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, and as I mentioned, all the three countries are led currently by military leaders. We all know the three countries historically have witnessed coup d'etats. Although in the past we have seen transition into more like democratic elected governments are following the coups, but that's not the case today in the three countries, and we are seeing that these military leaders are, you know, don't have the intention to hand over power to civilian rulers.
Very interesting. You've made very remarkable statements that I've put down here. So let me start off from the justification that I've been given. And that justification where the traditional partners in this region, largely France, and then, you know, we have United States and some EU countries, have no. To some extent, it does. Do you agree that those explanations or justifications why they may conceal other selfish interests are they valid? Is there a valid argument?
I mean, it depends who you ask. You know, if it's valid or not. I think clearly has been valid to a lot of people to that have resonated with them this narrative that the crisis in the region, the crisis in the three countries, it is because of France, for example. That's the narrative that they have been selling and telling their base of supporters, and has resonated. And to step back and what has given them some legitimacy and you know, why this message resonated with people, it's when you look at the situation in the three countries 10 years ago, or let's say when the French intervened in 2013. The situation continued to get worse every year. It started in Mali, initially in the north, northern Mali, have expanded to central Mali, and then crossed the borders to Burkina Faso and to Niger, and the conflict continued to expand. And every year, the level of violence continued to increase in all the three countries, and that's the narrative, you know, in part. That's one of the narrative used by the junta leaders, is that despite the French intervention, despite the French presence, these jihadist groups are the main actors in the conflict. You know, they continue to expand. They continue to conduct violence, but we cannot ignore as well, I think, the fact that these countries, despite that they were ruled by civilian leaders, all the three countries have been subject to abuse of power. I think the regimes that were ruling Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, despite that they were they were praised by the West. They were known to be corrupt. They were known to be abusing power. There were many scandals involving the presidents of the three countries. Yet the West continued to close their eyes on what's been happening. And that's why when this junta leaders came in, they have gained some legitimacy, saying, look, one of the reasons we continue to be in this conflict is because we have these leaders that were put by the West, and they continue to abuse power, and yet we continue to be in conflict. The conflicts continue to expand in our territory. So that gave them some legitimacy, and that's why, and also it's very hard to defend the West intervention in general, especially France, but also the U.S., who were the main traditional partners when it comes to counterterrorism efforts in the region. So it's very difficult to defend their partnership with the three countries because, as I mentioned, because of the situation, how it was in 2012 and where we are today. So the situation continued to work, to get worse every year. That doesn't mean that the coup d'etats are the solution, but at the same time, I think there was a need for a change of and the rethinking of the efforts, so counterterrorism efforts, in addition to stabilization efforts in the region that France and other traditional Western allies have failed to address, and therefore that give them as you asked give them a valid valid excuse for these junta leaders to be in power. And to garner support among locals in the three countries. I'm not saying all of them, that they have, overwhelming support throughout the three countries, but they do have support that are trying to blame France and the U.S. for the ongoing problems.
You did mention, I've clearly that we've had a few previous episodes where to me, I found admirable where the West have or are admitting or accepting that we could have done better. So that to me, I think, should be acknowledged to some extent, to say we have failed to some extent. But then again, like you rightly mentioned, some elements of the West are also questioning, this justification for the coup. But there's something you mentioned that I've not really looked into, because at the wake of the coup, at the wake of all of this, we saw, people on the streets having, anti-French placard. We have, people bringing in French, we've seen French, they've been sacked. We've seen the US military sacked in Niger and all of that. But you mentioned something about opposition within those countries that are beginning to question this coup. How significant is the voice of this opposition, and what basis are they relying on to question this contest?
Yeah, I think eventually it's going to get caught up. To get caught up on the junta leaders, because the narrative that are selling, it's not does not resonate with the situation on the ground. Economic situation in all the three countries is getting worse every month. Access to electricity is becoming a problem even in the capitals. Access to water, to potable water. Everyone that I speak to, I spent about 14 years working in the region, and everyone I speak to who are based in in the three countries, the economic situation is really dire. It's dire, and it continues, as I mentioned, to get worse. So that eventually is going to cut up, and frustration might take people to the streets increasingly despite the risks, because let's not forget that the junta leaders are very good at intimidating people and intimidating everyone who speaks against them. They have done they have shut down newspapers, TV stations, civil society organizations because they spoke against against the junta leaders. Just more recently, I think just earlier this week or later last week, there have been arrests in Mali of political figures because they have voiced their concerns about the situation in Mali. Eventually, people, the Malian people, the Nigerian, the Burkinabes will realize the road and the vision that these junta leaders are choosing is not the best, and it's not gonna bring the three countries out of the ongoing crisis and conflicts. The other thing that is going to get caught up with them, one of the excuses to try to legitimate to make the coup d'etat as legitimate, is to address the security situation in the three countries. That has not been addressed. I think the three countries continue to witness almost daily attacks, daily violence, especially in rural areas. So despite choosing to work with the new partners like Russia, for example, they continue to struggle to protect people, especially in rural areas. So this ongoing violence and continued expansion of armed groups, of jihadist groups, especially in the three countries, it's going to also get caught up with the excuse used by the junta leaders, and that will continue to make people frustrated. In addition to the economic, to the dire economic situation, and the three countries were relying heavily on aid and also economic relations with France and the US and the European Union in general. Those were the main donors to the three countries. Mm-hmm. And now these partners are no longer providing similar aid and assistance they were providing to Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. On top of also, as you mentioned, we talked about it earlier, the regional tensions with ECOWAS members. And there is an ongoing tensions between Niger and Benin, for example, in terms of like the exportation of oil through Benin, from Niger to Benin to the port of Cotonou. So there are just like, and without these economic relations and trade relations with countries in the region, these three countries will continue to be isolated and therefore struggle economically, which we are already seeing signs of that. And people are really feeling it in the three countries.
So it does seem that there is a very likelihood that this can implode internally from people, airing their grievances with the reduced livelihood and stuff like that. But there's something very clear, and you've touched upon it in the last sentences. You mentioned that this alliance was also one that was motivated by ECOWAS threats to intervene in Niger. And then again, over the years, we've also looked at the partnership with Russia, for instance, was it one that was opportunistic, or was it one that was original in the original plan? So I guess my question is, can the alliance survive if its motivation was a defense pact against ECOWAS threat? So can it survive if that was it, or is there a prospect of it being reintegrated back into ECOWAS?
I believe I personally, I think being isolated is not going to help the alliance to be successful. not going to be successful? I mean, first of all, because these are lockdown countries, like landlocked countries. They don't have access to ports. They don't have, you know, to the sea. And that's really key in terms of economic relationships and trade and economic development. So being isolated and also having these tensions with neighboring countries who are key economic partners, like Nigeria with Niger, and also like Benin, Togo with Burkina Faso and Niger, Mali also with the Cote d'Ivoire and Senegal. You know, these are really their key partners. But if tensions continued and the three countries continue to be isolated, the alliance unlikely to survive, right? And not just in terms of, you know, economically, but also security wise. Why I say that? Because the conflict is a cross border conflict. So, you know, the groups that these countries are dealing with, they don't believe in borders or countries. Like they operate cross borders. So without a regional collaboration, regional partnership and intelligence share and joint operations, these groups will continue to exploit and benefit from this division between the alliance of the Sahel and ECOWAS. For example, right now jihadist groups have reached northern Benin and now they are operating in northern Benin. And without collaboration between Benin and Niger and Burkina Faso, they will be unable to counter the rise of these groups in this area. Same thing between the borders of Ghana and Burkina Faso, between Mali and Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina and Cote d'Ivoire. There have been also security and diplomatic tensions between Burkina Faso and Cote d'Ivoire. So those tensions only benefit jihadist groups in these areas because of that lack of collaboration. So security-wise also, these three countries will not survive. Yes, they do rely, you know, they have built in relationship with and relying on the Russian mercenary groups, formerly known as Wagner, now it's called Africa Corps. But this did also... Already, we have seen track record of this group carrying extrajudicial killings and human rights violations in Mali. And the group has the history, and then it's well documented of such abuses, not just in Mali but also other parts of Africa. So what does that do? Is you know, this act of abuses builds new grievances among certain communities against the state, against these junta leaders, against the militaries of these countries. So that will backfire. Instead of rebuilding that trust with local communities, now we are seeing that this trust is again, you know, being broken, and grievances now are emerging again against the militaries. And we need to remember that because of that lack of trust, that how these jihadist groups managed to establish themselves in certain communities. So to go back to your question, I think, you know, collaborating with mercenary groups that are short-term fix, you know, they might carry operations and conduct acts that former partners like France will not carry, might assist, you know, might reach results in the short term, but in the long term, it's very problematic because of the reasons I mentioned of human rights violations, the creating grievances against the state in most affected areas by the conflict. So in the mid and long term, the alliance would not survive without regional collaboration, without collaboration also with international community, including the US and France. Of course, France, the US, the European Union have to rethink of how this partnership should look like and learn from the problems and from the mistakes that have led to the current situation. But without genuine win-win partnership with the West, I think that this new alliance is unlikely to survive in the long term.
You've mentioned, so I was going to talk on the jihadist, but I think I should just quickly talk on the democracy, and also we're talking about how these groups or these junta groups legitimate, you know, there we know underneath all of that it conceals another selfish interest. But we can look at the Sahel, for instance, and look at how, let's say France, for instance, France dealings with, let's say Chad. We see Chad and how that might be different from how it's dealt with in Niger, for instance. And, you know, we had one guest come and say and explain why it looks like France may have looked the other way when, you know, there was some kind of violations from the military government, authoritarian government in Chad, compared to, you know, these inconsistencies and all of that. But I've also seen in Chad, even though we can question, you know, that transition back to democracy, we've seen the return to democracy in Chad. Do we see, so from my own research, people in Africa, people in that region want democracy. But it does seem that the democracy that has been practiced in the last how many years since independence has been one that has not yielded the dividend that it wants. And but does Chad, what we've seen in Chad, and what we've also seen recently in Senegal, and all that, do this present some sort of blueprint or hope that there might be, and like what you said as well, you know, the prospect of people, citizens in these free countries feeling the weight of, you know, the economic livelihood, can they also propel that change towards that? Do you see that prospect of that happening?
We have to be really careful of calling, you know, calling what happened in Chad as a transition to democracy and democratic. And I think for anyone who's following very closely the you know, the country and the region in general, they might disagree that the transition have been democratic in Chad. I think it has been just, you know, if you want to call it just a show, but everyone knew like who was going to win and how, you know, the elections are just being held to say that we held elections. And that's why I push back. Like when every time I hear the West, like in the US or Europe, praising countries that have, you know, or been able to successfully organize elections, I think we need to stop, you know, measuring democracy by holding elections. And I think it's just a box that it's being checked. And that has happened in Niger, happened in Burkina Faso, in Mali, and yet look where we are today in the three countries. So we have to be really careful. Like, I mean, organizing the elections and transitioning to civilian rules is not enough. The Senegal is the exception. Why? Is because they have their own history in terms of tensions around the elections. You know, it's very apparent. However, historically, they managed to survive those tensions because they have established stronger institutions in place that were able to push back against any president who tried to violate the constitution. And that's why they were able to push back against some decisions that were going to create further tensions domestically, as happened with Macky Sall when decided to postpone the elections. The institutions were in place to say, no, we're not going to postpone the elections. We are going to hold the elections. So that those kind of institutions, you know, do not exist in so far. At least they don't have enough influence. They never had the influence in Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and that's why we continue to fall in this situation. Mm-hmm. And you know, to go back to what I said earlier, yes, we had the democratically elected, you know, presidents, but these presidents, as I mentioned, there is a well-documented act of abuse of power, abuse of resources, and that have, instead of investing in developing strong institutions, these individuals were benefiting from the position for more power and to maintain that power. And the same thing in Chad. So I think we have to be really careful of what's happening in Chad as well, because the elections happened by design. It's not because of the democratic process. That's the difference. You know, say Senegal is an exception because of the strong institutions. When it comes to the West and how they react to the elections, it has been one of the problems that has been used by the alliance, by the Sahelian alliance, to delegitimate the West because of just double standards. So the France and the U.S. were very quickly to jump in and call. You know, call it a coup in Mali and Burkina Faso, and then later on Niger. It took them a while before to call it a coup, but they have not called that a coup in Chad. They need so this double standard of reacting to what's happening in the region from one country to another, also it's being used by the junta leaders in terms of like this double standard stuff of how they react to each coup, and that's why it has opened doors to new partners like Russia, for example, that do not meddle in the local domestic politics. They intervene without dictating of what should be done in terms of the elections or the development of the democracy, building the democracy in the country. So that has opened doors for Russia because they don't ask those questions. They don't raise the questions of human rights violations. All those are problematic, of course, but at the same time, it benefits the junta leaders because they could govern the way they want to govern. As I mentioned, being autocratic as they are, they continue to silence their speaking against them. They continue to eliminate, if you want to use, we're not saying eliminating like killing, but just sidelining any organizations, any individuals from the media to political parties that are standing in their way, and no one is there to hold them accountable. In the past, with France, the U.S., the European Union, will put some pressure on the political leaders. But today there is no pressure. They could make decisions whatever they want in terms of decisions, as we have seen, in terms of transition. You know, put in 3 years before holding elections as a deadline, 4 years, and no one is there to challenge them.
But I'll come back to democracy before, and I wanted to go back to the jihadist group. So we've seen interest in the coastal states in Benin, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, and we've seen the possibility, like Riley says, a cross-border, these crimes are like cross-border stuff. And we see whereby the jihadists are getting some sort of, I think of, in the research I've seen where another group that jihadists might be getting some attention from, it's the header group, like the Fulani header group, where they're able to capitalize on some of the grievances that these different groups have in these communities, and then be able to recruit them. And then, so basically I'm saying, we've seen the problem, the insecurity, insurgency, jihadism in the Sahel transiting or, going cross border to this coastal state and threatening to disrupt these places. we've also seen the call for like coastal states, you know, forming like some kind of military alliance, geomilitary alliances, and then, you know, relating to the military basin and, you know, US, for instance, shopping for where to have its military basin. How do you see this in terms of further militarizing the region? And does he have to escalate or de-escalate the situation? Well, how do you see this going? How should we react to it?
There is a traffic jam of in terms of like initiatives, you know, security, development, stabilization efforts that are taking place right now, or at least in the process of like coastal state, because of the fear that jihadist groups will expand and will continue to expand, and the conflict will reach coastal states. Effectively, these groups have reached coastal states, at least the northern parts of coastal states. They have carried attacks in Benin, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, not in northern Ghana, but doesn't mean that they don't operate and they are not present in northern Ghana. Mm-hmm. So that has this concern that started initially 2018, 2019, have brought a lot of efforts. As I mentioned, it became a traffic jam, especially now with a lot of programs that are not being able to operate and, you know, to be implemented in the alliance of the Sahel, Italian alliance countries, in Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso. So a lot of institutions, a lot of organizations now have been deployed into coastal states. It's good. I mean, it in terms of like prevention, you know, that's good. But what we have to be cautious about is repeating the same mistakes that have been taking place in the Sahel. Some of those mistakes, for example, the acts of stigmatization by security forces. This has played a major factor in terms of like recruitment efforts among jihadist groups, and drove communities to join jihadist groups because of acts of abuses by state forces. Mm-hmm. So that needs to be fixed. And unfortunately, we have seen some of the similarities in coastal states so far. So that needs to change. The other issue is the other lesson is when France came in 2013 and with the Malians, they did a really good job chasing jihadist groups out of urban centers of the key towns. And let's remember that the ongoing conflict is mostly rural. It's not in urban centers. So this is a counterinsurgency that is taking place in the rural areas. And a lot of the trainings that took place that the European Union provided to Malian, Nigerian, and Burkinabe forces were focused on urban centers, how to rescue hostages, how to protect, you know, key infrastructures in the key towns. But these armies continue to lack resources and capabilities to protect the population in rural areas where the conflict is mostly taking place. So that needs to be also taken in consideration when we look at this military efforts that are taking place in coastal states. Combined with military efforts, as I mentioned, you know, it's somewhat easier to chase these groups out of urban centers and some areas and dislocate them. But the struggle has been how to take over that area and create an environment for these groups not to be able to return to these areas and continue to exist. Because liberating them for 1 month, liberating some areas and chasing them out of some areas for a month or 2 months, it's not sufficient. You need to dislocate them as well as creating an environment, security, development, an environment that these groups cannot return. Like, for example, having security apparatus in place, bases, and in addition to also providing public services that for the population to return and return to somewhat, you know, the normal life. So that has not happened in the past 10 years of this counterterrorism effort, is that the stabilization efforts focused a lot on what is called technical. For example, you know, maybe rehabilitating a school or building a health center, but did not address root causes of issues that drive the grievances among certain communities. Those are the drivers that prevent these groups from gaining support in certain communities. Not just building a school, not just building a health center. I think there is a need of creating this environment among the population that would not allow these groups to return. So there are a lot of lessons learned from the Sahel that should be taken into consideration and try to prevent in coastal states. And the focus should not be on the military effort for the reasons I mentioned. I think should be coupled with mainly establishing a trusted relationship between the state and those local communities in those areas. And when I say state, including state forces, because those local communities in rural areas are your first partners, are your first legitimate partners, if you want to say it. So without the support of those local communities and without their trust, the fight to eradicate the presence of these groups in this area is going to be very challenging.
Okay, very interesting. Very interesting. Let me come to the last question and ask you a very broad question to finish with. And I think that ties well into what you've been saying. So you mentioned earlier that the West, and you just said it now, what the West or what they needs to be done in the coastal state. But let's come back to these free states and say, how should the West, like Rally said, needs to rethink its strategy, what it's been doing in the past and what it's done wrong, lessons. So how should the West re-engage with these places? And again, regional bodies like ECOWAS, in a way, may have also pushed this group. How do you think they need to engage with this? With this alliance, does ECOWAS itself need any kind of reform? What does it need to do to either bring these people back into the fold and dissuade, you know, that connection with Russia? And how do you see, you know, in a prognostic way, what do you see in the next couple of years in that region? Do you see any change? Do you see, you know, just take a broad look and just.
It's a million-dollar question. I think the first step is to be able to bring this, you know, to bring him to the table and have some sort of dialogue, a conversation. I think because right now we are at the stage where relationships are severely damaged between this alliance between Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, and ECOWAS, as well as with France and the US, European Union in general. Mm-hmm. So there is a need for that dialogue to be able to maintain that conversation instead of totally cutting the side. Unfortunately, I think we reached an unprecedented level of diplomatic tensions, and I honestly don't see how this could be fixed in the very short term. Like it's very difficult unless a miracle, you know, happens. But I think, as I mentioned, sitting at the table and for the region for these countries to admit first of all, that they have a problem. You know, they have some problems that need to be addressed, and they can bring those problems to the table to the international community, to regional and international partners. So it starts with that. It starts with like admitting that there are problems that need to be addressed. Needs to be addressed. We have common issues. We have common problems that we need to address together. Either be it economic or security problems. So I think being able to have that frank conversation, I don't see any other way. But it's right now, it's very difficult to see the junta leaders accepting, saying that you know, have been able to come to the table and say, here are our problems. How can you help us? How we can work together to address them? Simultaneously, also the West should be able to make the region, first of all, also a priority. Because right now, unfortunately, it's very difficult to say that the Sahelian conflict is a priority to the U.S., is a priority to France or the European Union. It's you know, unfortunately, it's and rightly and not rightly, but I can say it that it is not top priority. And Sahelian states know that, and they sell that narrative to the population that the Sahelian conflict is not a priority. So as long as that perception continue, it's going to be really difficult for the international partners to regain the trust of this of the three countries. And the international community need to realize that what they have done in the past, a lot of times look good on paper, what's been discussed, what's been designed on in terms of strategies or programs, what have been designed in Paris, Brussels, Washington, you know, look good on paper, but it does not reflect the reality on the ground. And so any efforts, either be it security, stabilization efforts, need to match and need to be realistic. I think that the international community need to be realistic of what could be achieved when it comes to programs being implemented, not just in the Sahel, but also in coastal states. One of the main struggles with stabilization efforts is the tangible results of the stabilization and development efforts. I continue to cite one of the examples provided by locals in the region is that, you know, the US and France, they talk, and I keep saying France, but all the European Union in general, their efforts, it's not tangible, it's not visible to them. And then when you compare their efforts to China, for example, they say, look, the Chinese came in. Look, we know that the Chinese built this bridge, they built this highway, they built this, but we don't see what the US have done or what the French have done in the country. So I think the West needs some, as I mentioned, realistic results, and also things that could be seen, could be felt, could have an impact on the local population. So I think to summarize, it's like there is a need for a conversation, frank conversation, frank dialogue between all the parties involved, the Sahelian states with the regional body, the ECOWAS, and also with the international community, have that frank conversation. And then the international community's efforts need to be realistic in terms of objectives and what they need to achieve.
Brilliant, brilliant. This is well summed and well captured. Raida, thank you very much for such deep insight into this very important topic. We're very grateful to have you join us today from Washington. I know it's quite early. I can imagine waking up by night to do this. So really, really appreciate your effort, your support, and your insights. And I'll keep in touch once this is ready to be published, and would inform you and let you know, and help employ you to help us share it among your network as well once it's out. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a very great morning.
Thank you, Michael. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'll keep in touch.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for tuning in today to a wonderful episode with Ryder Lemori, where we've discussed the alliance of Sahel states in the troubled Sahel region. Join me to thank Ryder, and once again, I implore you to stay tuned, and I'll see you next week. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. For now, stay blessed.